Hey everyone, it's Colin. How's it going? So, not long ago, I put out a call for questions. I realized it's been a long time since I've done a Q&A episode, and for some reason I skipped doing one in 2019. Not quite sure how that happened. But I figured, you know what, let's go for it with another one. And I am impressed with the questions that you came back with, because I do remember in years past when I did these that a lot of the questions that I would get would be fairly obvious ones or fairly kind of monotonous ones, like, you know, what's your favorite game console? What's your favorite game? I'm having this problem with my Game Boy. How do I fix it? You know, that kind of stuff. You all gave me some really good kind of more conceptual questions, and I really appreciate that. So let's get through them. If any questions get asked between when I record this episode and when it gets published, I'm going to answer them just directly in the comments on Patreon. So don't worry, I'm going to try to answer everyone's questions if they ask them. But I've got a few here that you've posted up already. So let's get started. Jamie asks, if I could be a fly on the wall for one game or one tech item, what would be the most interesting? There's lots of really interesting products, games, tech items, technologies, whatever out there that I would love to know the backstory on. But at the same time, I don't necessarily want to. I've worked in the IT industry long enough to know that, you know, sometimes you just don't want to know how the sausage is made, is how the saying goes. And there's a lot more kind of like dysfunction and drama and politics and like just hacking stuff together technically, then you may realize that goes into tech in general. So I wouldn't necessarily kind of want to have some of my like dreams crushed by knowing the true story behind something that I'm really, really like, you know, fond of, to find out that this thing that I absolutely love and maybe a lot of people love was born out of like backstabbing and political crap and, you know, like in the office, you know, workplace and lots of disagreements, and no one had their act together in terms of what the product would even be. And at the last minute, they just slapped some existing technology together to kind of get it to work. And like, you know, that kind of flies against, you know, what a lot of people, myself included, would kind of have in our heads about how products are made, where you've got this, you know, nice team of engineers and designers, and they all sit down and they come to a perfect agreement as to how the product is supposed to work and what the end is going to be like. And, you know, everyone goes off and just does their bit and they all collaborate really well and they're having a good time. And it's, you know, it's all coming together exactly as they would have hoped. And then they manufacture it and they didn't have any problems with that because they all knew what they were doing and, you know, didn't design any flaws into the product or anything like that. I don't think that exists, right? I think it's all just chaos the entire time. So from that perspective, I don't think there's really much in terms of technology specific products that I would really want to know the story on, just for fear that it would ruin my perception of that product. I can tell you one thing that I do think would be interesting to learn about the process of how they are made is cars. Not necessarily the assembly part, but like, how do you go from a blank sheet of paper or, you know, a blank document in a CAD program to a vehicle rolling off the assembly line? Because there's a lot that goes into a vehicle, not just from the design standpoint, but the engineering standpoint and costs and profit margins and all these different teams of people that have to work together to, you know, design and make this car work. I mean, it's not just you design the outside of the car and then the engineers figure out how to put an engine and wheels on it. And then they hand the blueprints off to the manufacturing line and they just build the car. I mean, it's way deeper than that. I mean, just looking at the outside of the car, you've got not only the actual appearance of it, but the appearance has to follow regulations from the government, you know, in terms of like, the tail lights and headlights have to work in a certain way and be, you know, visible in a certain way. Well, how do you make those requirements jive with how you want the car to look? Plus, there's aerodynamics you have to think about because fuel efficiency is always a factor. So how do you, you know, tweak your design to be as aerodynamic and fuel efficient as possible, again, without like ruining the way you want the car to look? There's safety, not just in terms of getting in a crash and crumple zones and that kind of stuff, you know, protecting the occupants, but also pedestrian safety, because that's a big part of how cars are designed as well. You know, making sure that pedestrians aren't hurt more, you know, more than they have to be if they were to get hit by a car. That's all just going into the outside of it. I mean, you've got the engineering part of it, the powertrain, the suspension, and all the various systems that have to work together to make the car work, plus the interior, plus how do you even manufacture the thing? Like, which parts do you get? Which suppliers do you go with? All that kind of stuff. I think the like a level of collaboration between all the different groups that have to work on that kind of stuff, that would be the most interesting thing to learn about. Like, just how do so many people come together to make a vehicle actually happen? And how many compromises are there along the way? Like, you know, if you were to ask the person at the beginning who designed the thing, what's it going to look like, and then compare it to the end state, and then talk to them about like, what were all the things that, you know, had to be compromised on in order to get to that end state, that would be really interesting to hear that story. So kind of a long answer to a short question, but we'll get used to it. I have a feeling this podcast is going to be full of them. That's what I would be most interested in, is something really complicated like a car, especially from like a manufacturer or a model that I'm personally don't really care so much about, because then I don't have any emotional attachment to it. You know, to kind of ruin my perception of that brand or, you know, that model or whatever. That would be really interesting. Okay, next question from Drombeg, asking, what's the one item in my toolbox that I would consider a must-have for a DIYer? My answer is going to be probably a really good pair of flush cutters. And the reason for that is I love nothing more than to use high quality tools that work really well. I don't like buying cheap tools. I have a hard time justifying buying cheap tools simply because more likely than not, I know they'll either one, not last very long, or two, I'm going to hate using them. Flush cutters are something that I use often enough, both doing my own DIY kind of stuff at home, but also at work, that I need to have a good pair of them. The funny thing with flush cutters specifically, and maybe let me back up for a second to explain what those are. Those are kind of like diagonal cutters, you know, for cutting wire and that kind of stuff. The difference is diagonal cutters, if you look at like the profile of the blade, it's like a V shape, right? So you've got two V shapes that kind of come together to make the cut. That's not as clean of a cut as what a flush cutter can do, because on a flush cutter, one side of the blade is perfectly flat. So on a flush cutter, like only one side of the blade has been kind of ground down to an angle. The other side is perfectly flat, and those come together to produce a really, really clean cut. Flush cutters are the only acceptable tool to use to cut like zip ties, for example. You know, if whenever you put a zip tie on something and you zip it tight and you cut the tail off, the excess bit, if you use a diagonal cutter, you get that little bit that sticks out and it's always sharp. And of course, at some point in the future, you're going to run your hand across it and like get cut up real bad. Everybody hates that. Flush cutters won't do that, because flush cutters will let you get right up against, I don't know what that little part is called, the part where like the tail of the zip tie actually goes through and like zips tight, you know, the zip part of the zip tie. Flush cutters let you get right up to that and cut that clean, so you don't have that little bit that sticks out. Flush cutters are also fantastic, obviously, for cutting wire, but also for trimming excess leads off of the bottom of PCBs. Like if you're doing through-hole components, you know, putting in a new capacitor or an LED or whatever, you got the extra bit of the leads that stick out. Flush cutters work really well at cutting those nice and clean and flat. So that the ends on those leads aren't overly sharp, which is what kind of like diagonal cutters, Lyman's pliers, and all that kind of tend to do. Flush cutters are fairly cheap. I mean, mine, I'll include a link in a comment underneath this episode to the specific model that I use. I don't know the model number off the top of my head. It's by Heyco. They're like $10. They're so cheap. Everyone should have at least one or two pairs of them. That, long story short, I'm going with flush cutters. But in general, other advice that I would have is look at the tools you use the most, and then also compare those to the tools you hate using the most, like the tools that just never quite work right for you, that you don't like the feel of, that don't do quite as good of a job as you would expect them to do. Do like a Venn diagram of those two categories: tools you use a lot, tools you hate. Where they overlap, take those tools, throw them away, go out and buy better ones. Because life is too short to suffer with crappy tools that you hate. Just go buy good ones. You don't need to blow the bank either. A lot of times a small, improvement in quality is enough to make a huge difference, and that doesn't really cost you a whole lot. So that's what I'm going with. Okay, next question. Makho asks, am I planning on doing any more Game Boy related videos? I briefly answered this one in a comment because I didn't want to leave them waiting, but yes, I do plan on doing more Game Boy and like gaming related videos. My head just hasn't really been in that space lately. So I haven't been doing videos for two reasons. The first is I don't really think there's been a whole lot of exciting stuff going on related to Game Boys in the last 6 months or so. I feel like we've kind of plateaued in terms of innovation with mods and upgrades, that sort of stuff. For a few years there, we were getting tons of stuff, right? Like the Bivert options, making those smaller and easier to install and work better and all that. Backlight kits, front light kits, rechargeable battery packs, all that kind of stuff. We were getting lots and lots of that for years. But it seems like we've kind of hit the peak with the release of all these different options of backlit Game Boy Color displays. Because that kind of opened the floodgates. Like once we got to a point where people were able to generate inexpensively, or at least relatively inexpensively, all these like interposer boards that go between the motherboard of the console and the replacement display to translate like the video signals between the two. Once we got to a point where those became relatively inexpensive and they could be made for various different kinds of consoles, like I just said, there's a few different options for backlit Game Boy Color displays. Those kits have been kind of retooled to work on things like the Neo Geo Pocket Color, and some other consoles. That kind of opened the floodgates in one way of, hey, we can put backlit displays in all the things now. But at the same time, like, where do you go from there? I mean, we've kind of done everything else. So unless you want to look at doing case swap kind of stuff, where I did a video on this where there's a guy who takes like original DMG shells and swaps in the components, like the motherboard and the screen and stuff from a DS Lite to basically, make kind of this Frankenstein console thing. I mean, unless that gets really popular and these manufacturers come up with kits you can use to make building one of those a lot easier. Because right now it's just this huge mess of wires. It's very labor intensive to do that sort of swap. But if, they come up with a way where it's like, here's this PCB and it attaches to the original circuit board from the DS Lite and it fits in the DMG shell perfectly and all that kind of stuff. Like, unless there's a demand for that and a way to produce those, I don't think there's many other places that we can go with extending handheld gaming, for better or for worse. So instead of just kind of repeating myself and doing the same kinds of videos over and over, like I could crank out a bunch more. Here's how you install a backlight kind of video, or here, let me, watch me customize this Game Boy Advance kind of video. But I just feel like I'm repeating myself and I want to keep doing unique content instead of falling into this trap of comfort of, well, I know how to produce this kind of video, so I'm just going to keep doing it over and over. So hopefully at some point we'll get some more innovation in that sphere. There's also plenty of other game consoles that I do have on my radar to talk about and look at. either from a modding perspective or like a retrospective kind of thing. One thing that I think might actually be really interesting is to look not necessarily at the history of a console from its production and like mass market appeal kind of angle, just like the history of the Super Nintendo. It was developed in this year by these people and critical acclaim and sold X number of units in its first year, that like the typical kind of retrospective. What I'd be more interested in would be something along the lines of like, here's what the modding scene for the PlayStation looked like in the late 90s. Something like that. You know, like going quite a bit deeper, maybe not from the mass market kind of angle, but like, here's all the different options for mod chips that there were, or these were the companies that produced replacement shells, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Like how the hardcore gaming people kind of got into it. Maybe that's something that we'll look at in the future. The other reason why I haven't really been covering them is just been interest. My head hasn't been in that space for a while, and I'm sure I'll get back into it. I haven't given up on gaming by any means, but it's been less of a priority for me lately. As you've probably seen with the kind of videos that I've created, I've been on more of a retro computing and like retro audio kind of kick. That's just what I've been interested in. I've fallen into some really interesting stories about like retro computing, like their history, the retrospective stuff that I'm still trying to digest. My recent video about AUX is one of them. That's actually the first in a multi-part kind of series that I'm working on. I have a lot more research to do to put all that together, but that's just what's been really kind of consuming my interest lately. At some point, I'll get through all of that and then see something interesting on the gaming scene, and I'll flip back into that. But what I learned a long time ago was I shouldn't try to create content that I'm not interested in making. There have been a few occasions where I've needed to make a video about something, and I didn't want to do it, but I did it anyway. And if you watch them, you can probably tell that I just wasn't as into it as I would have been in other videos from around that time. So I could create more videos about gaming, but I just wouldn't be so into it, and it would show, and that doesn't do anyone any good. So long story short, yes, more gaming, more Game Boy videos, they will be happening. I don't know when. Probably not in the short term, but eventually, absolutely, we'll get there. Cyril asks, a little bit of history about the Discman. That's a fantastic idea. It's kind of been in the back of my mind. The trouble with doing that, it wouldn't necessarily be so much like a historical retrospective, like talking about the development of it, because it's a fairly straightforward product. What I would be more interested in looking at would be the design and how it evolves over time, you know, from the very first Discman to more or less the very last one, because Sony doesn't make them anymore. Sony actually stopped making Discmans years ago. But that would be a really interesting journey, would be to just kind of go through and look at, here's what they looked like in the 80s, into the 90s, and then into the early 2000s. How did the features change? A comparison of like the battery life, even on its own, would be really interesting to see. You know, you got so much more battery life by this point in time. Here are the technological advancements that made that battery improvement possible, that kind of stuff. The challenge with doing a video like that is I just don't have enough Discmans to do it, like especially the really old ones. I've got a few. I've kept all the ones that I had growing up. Well, except for a few. Basically, the ones that meant the most to me, I've kept. There's one that I definitely need to go on eBay and buy again. It was my very first Sony-branded Discman that it just got lost to time. I've had several over the years. The very first one that I had wasn't very good, and it wasn't Sony-branded. The second one was a bit better, but it also wasn't Sony-branded. And by the time I switched to a Sony one, I could just tell it was so much better. Because Sony was one of the first ones to produce Discman. So by the like mid-90s, I think, was when I got my first Sony Discman. Like, they were so much further ahead of the game than everybody else the difference in quality was pretty apparent. And I think that might play into a video like that too. But the big thing is I need to get a lot of the retro Discmans in order to produce a video like that. Stuff from the 90s and 2000s is pretty easy because that stuff isn't very expensive. You know, I could reach out to my friends at Free Geek and ask them, hey, could you keep an eye out for these sorts of things as they come in, throw them in a bin, you know, set them off to the side, let me know, I'll dig through them, you know, give you some money for the trouble or whatever. But the old ones from the 80s, those have a following. And you look on eBay, and they go for some serious money. Some of them well over $100 each. And of course, those are going to be the most iconic ones or the most interesting ones that I would actually want to do a video on. So unfortunately, I don't think I'd be able to do a video like that soon. It's something that would take time because it's more of a, I have to stumble across these sort of type, you know, sort of scenario instead of like, let's just go and buy a bunch of them because that would cost a ton of money. I mean, it would just cost a ton of money. And I don't really want to do the whole, let's just go through Google image search and find a bunch of pictures of these and then, you know, create a video around that, because to me, that's cheating. I want the challenge of creating something that is entirely done by myself, you know, where I shoot the footage myself. I can focus on particular attributes with the way I do camera angles and everything to draw focus to what I'm talking about, you know, in the narrative. You don't really get that option if you're just taking stock photos. There are plenty of people on YouTube who create entire videos around stock photos and stock footage. I don't want to be one of them. So that's a fantastic idea. And I hope to be able to do that someday. Maybe not so soon, though. Unless there's somebody out there who has a giant Discman collection who wants to donate it on. Hey, hit me up if you do. Although I don't know how many crazy people have giant Discman collections. Anyway. The last set of questions, although I think they're all kind of related. Asaf asks basically kind of, you know, what's it like in real life being a YouTuber? And then how do I relate to my friends and family and all that? You know, does any of that play in? Are they supportive? Are they like me? Are they like-minded to me? The answer is kind of yes to all of those. Of my friends who know that I produce videos, they're definitely supportive, although none of them are like my biggest fans. You know what I mean? And in some ways, I think that would be kind of weird on their part. Like if they're always gushing about, you know, whenever I see them, oh, I love that video you did. Oh, this is great. You know, that'd be like, okay, you can turn down the fanboyism a little bit. You know what I mean? So it's always kind of like, you know, we hang out and we're just normal people. Obviously, I'm a normal person. You are too. You know, and they may mention, oh yeah, I saw that video from a couple weeks ago. That one was cool. You know, and we'll just talk about it for like a minute. And then the conversation changes to something else that's totally normal. So yeah, I mean, they're supportive in that way. Like they think it's cool what I'm doing and all that, but not necessarily in a fanboy, fangirl kind of way. Along those lines, like, you know, a question in here about like, does my significant other watch my videos? She hasn't really admitted to it. I don't think she necessarily does. I have had my wife occasionally watch a video, but more like because I need her opinion on something about the edit. Like I remember asking her to watch my Free Geek documentary to let me know, like, what did she think about the pacing of the edit? Did I need to tighten stuff up? Did I need to rearrange some of the narrative in there? You know, were there certain clips that she liked better than others? You know, was the background music correct? That kind of stuff. Like, you know, where the vast majority of videos that I've created, it's just been me cranking the thing out, push the button to upload it, and then it's out in the world and I can't do anything about it. So it's tough to get feedback during the production process. A lot of it is just kind of based on instinct and intuition that I've kind of learned over the years about, you know, what's the right way to do this and will this go over well and does this work from a storytelling perspective. But every once in a while, you know, I get kind of questionable about some part of a video And, you know, I'll ask her, hey, can you look at this and let me know what you think? And that's really valuable. I don't think she's terribly huge into my channel. She's definitely supportive, very patient as well. Like, as I've, you know, gone off on these wild goose chases to find this old technology to shoot footage of and do research. Obviously, this is a very time consuming thing. So, you know, when I'm not at my day job, what free time I have to split between like real life and YouTube. So she's been very patient as I've tried to make all of this stuff, you know, work and fit in and still manage to lead a normal life and try to be as supportive of a husband to her as I can. But along those lines, I'm also very appreciative of all of you. I think I've said this before. I mean, I view all of my Patreon supporters as another kind of sounding board with these videos. Not too long ago, I posted a video that I was a bit on the fence as to whether I wanted to publish on YouTube to everyone or not, that USB SSD RAID video. It was an idea that I had in my head for quite a while, like over a year, because I thought it would be an interesting one of those stupid computer tricks kind of videos. I like doing those every once in a while just because computers are often very serious and all that, and sometimes doing stupid things with them is really amusing and sometimes surprising if you can get the stupid thing to work, like that whole, you know, can I install Windows 10 on like the oldest computer I can find video that I did that did really well. I mean, that video has an awful lot of views, way more than I would have ever expected. But sometimes you can't necessarily catch lightning in a bottle twice, you know what I mean? So that USB SSD RAID one was one that I thought, hey, this could be kind of fun. You know, like we can see how bad of an idea this is. Yeah, it'll probably work, but like how horrible is it? How easy is it to fail or break or whatever? So I had it in my head that that was going to be a good video, but it turns out in real life, I couldn't turn it into a good video. Like, there's no way to translate what I thought would be amusing in my head into a video that everyone else would think was amusing. And so that's kind of where I got stuck and why I asked for all of your opinion on it. And I really valued your opinion on that one because there was a lot of supportive comments, but there were a lot of this is a cool video, but kind of statements in there as well. And ultimately that made me realize that, you know, my gut was telling me the video wasn't really ready for prime time. And enough comments from you all were telling me it wasn't quite ready either. So I feel more at peace with not having published it than taking that risk and publishing it and having everyone hate it. Because I don't want to produce stuff that people hate. Because then it would have been a waste of time for everyone to produce videos that people don't like. So I appreciate your feedback on all that kind of stuff, your support, you know, letting me know what I did right, what I did wrong. And I hope that can continue. I like having that dialogue directly with all of you. I feel like I've got a closer kind of relationship between you than I would anyone else kind of in related to the videos that I do. I mean, I know there are plenty of people who follow me on Twitter and all that, but I've said this before, you know, you all have kind of voted with your wallets, like by supporting me on Patreon. That's like the highest compliment that I can get because you're willing to financially support me to do what I do because you like it that much. And it's still mind blowing to me that I'm even doing this right now. You know what I mean? Like, years ago, I would have just been sitting on the couch reading a book or playing video games right now when not answering questions that all these people on the internet, you know, are asking me. And so I really, really appreciate all of your support and kind of like your candid feedback like that. Don't worry, I'm not going to take it personal. I can't, not in the same way that I would a nasty comment off of like YouTube. I get plenty of those. But, you know, you and I all have kind of a different relationship. We're all in it together, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like, we're on the same team. You like the work that I do. I want to produce work that you like. So let's all work together to make that actually happen. Here we go again with me spending way too many words trying to say something simple. But anyway, thank you again for all of your support, for asking these questions. If you have more questions, go ahead, hit me up. I will try to get to them as I can. Maybe they'll spawn another podcast. Maybe this will be a thing that we do multiple times a year. I don't know. But I'll try to reply to any questions you send me as best I can. I'll just leave them in comments in the Patreon page or whatever. But I think that'll do it for now. If you have ideas for future podcast episodes, I've got some good ones cooking here, but I'm always curious as to what you want to hear me talk about. Feel free to hit me up with those too, and we'll see what we can do. But until then, as always, thanks for listening.